Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. It is Monday, February 27th, 2017. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. Commentary Magazine, 72 years old, monthly of intellectual probity, cultural analysis, bulwark against anti-Semitism, and the defense of the West and its institutions. Please join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe for $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, printed, mailed, and delivered right to your mailbox. With me, Noah Rothman, associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
So, gentlemen, last night at the Academy Awards, the most astonishing thing happened, which is that Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway read off the wrong winner, and after 2 minutes of congratulatory and self-congratulatory speeches by the makers of La La Land, somebody whispered in the ear of Jordan Horowitz, the producer of La La Land, and informed him that, in fact, they had lost the Oscar to Moonlight and that Moonlight was the actual winner. And it struck me as I was watching this unprecedented event that it dovetailed with a bunch of things that have been going on in American and indeed in Western society, in which one really can call into question the basic competence of the inner workings of elite institutions. That the Oscars is the second most watched event in the United States. Hundreds of millions of dollars of commerce are generated by it. The accounting firm of PricewaterhouseCoopers is responsible for the management of the envelopes in which the winners' names are kept hidden. And even here, it was not competent to hand the right envelope out to the right person to make sure that the most important cultural award given in the world was properly noted. And if you dovetail this, as we were talking about before the podcast, with some events of larger moment, not evanescent meaninglessness like who gets a Best Picture trophy, we could add to this indictment something like the Hillary Clinton campaign raised $750 million, had data analytics, had this, had that, had every consultant in the world, had every genius Democratic brain responsible for Barack Obama's brilliant 2012 technical victory. And nobody thought to wonder in the last week whether or not they had shored up their support in Ohio, Wisconsin, and Michigan such that they could have gotten the extra 100,000 votes to deny Donald Trump his surprise victory. Similarly, over the last month, we have seen the spectacle of Donald Trump coming into the White House and having a 31-year-old communications spokesman for Jeff Sessions write an executive order on the incredibly delicate and complex subject of refugee status, incompetently thus summoning chaos at airports and successful challenges to its constitutionality, a real black eye for the administration that came in under the aegis of its head being a businessman who knew how things worked and would clean up the mess in Washington that was made in his terms by all these idiots who made bad deals and don't know what the hell they're doing. Well, he certainly looks like he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. Hillary Clinton looked like she didn't know what the hell she was doing. The Oscars look like they don't know what the hell they're doing. And you really wonder, is this part of this institutional crisis in the United States that we've been seeing for the last 30 years, not only the lack of trust in institutions, but whether Americans are actually right to have lost trust in their institutions, not only because they don't seem to be doing a good job of serving their interests, but because they don't seem to know how to do anything properly and competently. Noah, what's your take on that little lecture I just delivered there?
Well, it was a very good lecture.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm going to use it as a jumping off point to ask a question of everybody that I already know the answer to because we discussed this previously, but you, dear listener, were not privy to that. So it's essentially a theme that we've all been sort of working our way towards, and that John's logic leads you to the necessary conclusion that, well, our expert class doesn't really know what the heck they're doing, so why don't we just defenestrate them and take over the shop? You know, it's almost a Marxian sort of view of the nature of the expert class as being hopelessly flawed, corrupt to the core, and also detached from the necessary functions and the sort of the incentive and rewards process that creates expert classes. So we've come to a place where they're sort of worthless and they need to be gotten rid of. This is sort of the theme to a book by War College professor Tom Nichols coming out recently, just came out actually, called The Death of Expertise, in which we as a society, the thesis is, we as a society have begun to prize amateurism and the sort of Rousseauian vision of nobleness that is conferred upon somebody who's just a babe in the woods, is very much a native. He argues that this is sort of the cause of our problems, not the result of our problems. So what do we think about that? Is the death of expertise the cause of our current condition, or sort of a result of our current condition?
Abe?
Well, I haven't read Tom Nichols' book, so I don't want to misrepresent its argument at all. But I think what we're looking at is the problem with the claim of expertise, I think, is sort of what's part of what's falling apart here, especially in the political realm. The basic competency problem is coupled with this – nothing seems to be in good hands. Yet we're being told by the same class of people that everything actually is in good hands. You don't understand. We've got this covered. I think that's the salt in the wound. That's what really rankles.
I was thinking about my grandparents who were immigrants. My father's parents, who were both born in Galicia, came to this country as teenagers. Lived in this country for 60, 70 years before their deaths, but never lost their accents. Working class people, lived in Brooklyn, very unassuming, quite timid. And the notion that people, their presumption was that they didn't know enough to question whether the people who were in charge knew what they were doing. They just simply presumed that a man of high standing and high, position was somebody who deserved to have that position. And you listened to him. You could disagree with him, I suppose. You could think that he was wrong about things, but certainly he was a formidable person and he knew more than you did. And the president, our leaders knew more than we did. And so therefore, you just sort of took on faith that they, when they said the country was in X condition or needed Y thing, that they were telling you the truth. That was, came to their adulthood in the 1920s, and they lived through the, my grandmother through the 1990s, and it would not have occurred to her to presume that the Secretary of Commerce, for example, wasn't a man of august standing, if she even knew who he was, or if she was ever to know who he was. That would be her presumption. And now I think people of the same order of life as my grandparents come at this from exactly the opposite conclusion. They now distrust institutions to such a degree that they do not believe, as a matter of course, that what they're being told is true by leaders. They'll believe it if they agree with other aspects of them, because those views dovetail with their own. But they will not think, if they are conservative, that Barack Obama is telling them the truth or knows more than they do or is operating on the basis of greater degree of information. And similarly, somebody in an opposite position wouldn't have believed that about George W. Bush, or won't believe that about Donald Trump, that we are in a position in which the general attitude of ordinary Americans is that their leaders are full of it in some sense or other.
Well, there's nothing unhealthy about that.
I'm not saying it's unhealthy.
Right.
Well, but there is something unhealthy about a distrust of general expertise, of the idea that anyone's truth is different from their own. The notion that a machine shop steward knows more about cutting steel and shaping tin than a CPA, and on a macro level,
again,
on a macro level, that the result of that is in effect where we have now a distrust of comparative advantage, where we're somehow designed, we're sort of lurching towards this
okay,
idea
well, let's,
of autarky.
Let's, which so is let's go into this because you're now making reference to things. So comparative advantage is the theory to explain.
If you don't know what comparative advantage is, you shouldn't be making economic policy.
Right. Okay. But comparative advantage is the essential description of the forces of world free trade, which is to say that countries should and do, as a matter of general proposition, it's better, not morally better, but economically more efficient for countries to if your country has a higher wage in textiles than a country with a lower wage in textiles, it makes sense for you to buy your textiles from the country with lower wages and import them into your country than to attempt to pay higher wages and put up tariff walls and sell the goods at a higher price in your own country, because A, it's inefficient, and B, it won't work anyway because the other goods will still somehow manage to sneak in, or you or people will travel abroad to buy them, and so in the end,
and meanwhile,
nothing
you're not focusing on the thing you do really well,
right? So in the American case, and the interesting thing is that the argument for comparative advantage is the way that Paul Krugman of the New York Times won his Nobel Prize in economics, and he now, of course, doesn't believe in it at all, as far as one can tell, since it dovetails against his radical political views. But I think the expertise – there are two issues here. So the expertise, I believe, based on the articles he wrote that the book is based on, that Tom Nichols is talking about, is expertise, let's say, on the history of foreign policy or the history of trade or the history of economics, in which people who have a greater grounding and a greater sense of, you know, cautionary examples of what can go wrong and what has gone right, and using history and using years of study as a basis for going forward on policy, that those people and that kind of expertise is no longer given credit whatsoever. Not only that, it's not being given credit by the Trump administration, which, for example, cares not a whit about whether anybody who works in the White House has had a moment's experience in the executive branch and knows how to navigate it efficiently so that it has a, let's say, comparative advantage in its own way to the co-equal branches of government, the legislative and the judicial, such that a person competent to write an executive order that dovetails with Donald Trump's wishes on refugee policy and to call a halt to it from these seven nations, that you might want somebody with some expertise in the writing of executive orders and making sure that they are constitutional, rather than handing the job to a 31-year-old right-wing firebrand who knows nothing except how to promote stories and talk trash on trade.
But it strikes me that there's a tremendous paradox at work here, because while we're finding this sort of gross incompetence everywhere at high levels, it seems to me at the same time this culture of credentials has risen up over the past decades, right? Where everyone is, if you don't have some graduate degree, you might as well not have gone to college at all. Where there's a major and a specialty for every conceivable job or placement in the Western world. The personnel departments are now, you know, these vast vetting machines, and yet all this bureaucracy has produced what?
Well, that doesn't seem incompatible to me at all. I mean, as these credentials, as credentialism has become paramount, and credentials have increased in ubiquity, that their value has decreased,
right?
And they're no longer trusted.
Well, look, so I think everybody understands that the sense of institutional decline that has overtaken America the last half century starts, in effect, with the Vietnam War. That, you know, we had 500,000 men under arms fighting in a faraway country in which, you know, we had massive advantages in every possible way and could not defeat the enemy, did not have a plan to defeat the enemy, lied about how we were handling it. You know, the military wasn't, as H.R. McMaster, our new national security advisor, wrote so brilliantly in his book, Dereliction of Duty, the military wasn't telling the politicians the things the politicians needed to hear to make good political decisions. The politicians lied to themselves, they lied to the voters, and, you know, they essentially sent people into a sort of death mill with no sense that there was, you know, anything except the goal but the goal was not really achievable. And so that was a generational crisis in which, you know, 58,000 people lost their lives and 100,000 were injured and all these, you know, and it was a, you know, terrible, it was just a horrendous waste. And if you go forward, we have, if you start from that as a base, you then go to, you know, people saying that the Iraq war was going to be easy, they would greet us as liberators and, you know, we'd be done in 5 minutes and mission accomplished. And then, of course, all this sort of Obamaite happy talk about recovery summer and how we were going to be able to simultaneously spend less and cover more people with Obamacare and you know all this use of expertise, you know, as a political tool to silence the opposition, you know, where they say things like anyone who's skeptical about global warming is told 97% of all climate scientists believe in it, so who are you to say that all the evidence that you can muster against it is that's just nonsense.
That's the appeal to authority fallacy in your side of sort of saying that now we suffer through the opposite. It's like an appeal to no authority.
No, but that speaks to what Abe said that you responded to, which is that if there's so much credentialism and then you have like third-rate people claiming that their credentials are important – at some point when people say, that's just a load of hooey, it's very hard to argue that point. Look, Andy Ferguson in our pages and the pages of the Weekly Standard and other places has been writing for years about the induplicability of social science experiments, right? So every day we get some study that says that 47% of people do this and people have this and they go through this and they have this anxiety and they have that. And it turns out that almost all of this is nonsense. These are all studies that are not duplicable, and when people attempt to duplicate them, 65 to 70% of them turn out to be induplicable, which means that we are still reporting daily and daily and daily on studies after studies that are based in nonsense, social science nonsense. And some of it supports your biases, and some of it attacks your biases and supports somebody else's biases. And at some point, truth will out, right? This is at some weird, serious point that Trump, you know, sort of landed around when he complained about political correctness, which is stop yelling at me, stop using false data to make an argument because I have no reason to trust that anything you're saying is true and you're citing facts that I don't know are true.
And by the way, this also plays into the Betsy DeVos nomination, right? How could she not be an expert on my terms by the qualifications that I claim expertise is recognized.
So that at the time is that somehow she wasn't aware of some very critical laws governing education policy, and that never occurred to education policy experts that perhaps this person who had spent a quarter century of her life studying this issue couldn't be informed on every aspect of it. Maybe, just maybe, there's too many aspects of it.
Right.
Right. Or there are too many laws governing it or the ins and outs. There's the ins and outs of this legislation are just nonsense intended to empower the credentialed at the expense of people who might have greater common sense. Because that's, of course, the other war here, which is part of the purpose of credentialing is to overcome people who say, look, common sense says that you can't bend the cost curve of healthcare and cover 30 million people. And then you say, no, I'm sorry, because you don't understand the formula. In fact, we can do everything with the same $5 and you can keep your doctor. And then the question is, are those people who do that, are they lying to themselves? Is Barack Obama, were they lying to themselves or did they use false information on purpose as propagandistically? And that was why it was such an issue with Obamacare when those tapes surfaced of Jonathan Gruber, the healthcare expert, saying, we're lying to people. Well, ha, 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 ha. We're doing this on purpose. We're lying to people because we know they'll never accept what we're giving them unless we put cherries on top of it and make them think that it's something other than what it's going to be.
Well, one thing we've not discussed is, and I don't think you can separate it from this issue, is the modern media environment that creates an echo chamber for these sort of ideas. The idea that same $5 can cover everything is magnified and echoed by Vox and Wonk Blog and given legitimacy and cachet. And the same thing happens on the right. I mean, all of a sudden we're being told by people like former House Speaker John Boehner that you can't really repeal Obamacare.
Right.
We told you the opposite a whole bunch of different times, and it was echoed, you know, incessantly by people on the right who had a whole bunch of legitimacy and a lot of data at their hands and their own ideas about policy. But guess what? You know, we just kind of made all that stuff up. And that's the sort of stuff that I think that's robbing the American public of of faith in their
credentialed leaders. So we have two things going on. We have the question of credentialism, and then we have the question of competence. But so I'll give you an example of the competence issue. The election day in 2012, if you remember, two different things happened that day. One was that the Romney campaign had a get-out-the-vote tablet computer system that was supposed to help them make sure that they could turn the vote out on election day. That crashed because it had never been properly field tested because they were too nervous it would get hacked, and they never – and so no one knew what was going on. And so that was the first bit of evidence that the Romney campaign was simply not going to function effectively that day. And the other was that the Obama campaign was generating votes in counties at numbers that no one had ever seen before. There were these small counties in Florida – where 7,500 more votes were turning up for Democrats because their get out the vote system was so sophisticated, and they had, and so it was a war of competence. That the story of the 2012 election was that Obama just had this supremely competent campaign that was so good that he could lose 4 million votes off his 2008 total and nonetheless win a comfortable victory. Even though people didn't like him and people liked him a lot less and people were enthusiastic voting for him, they could still pull them to the polls. And in 2016, the same people ran the Clinton campaign, and it turned out, guess what, that maybe all of that was nonsense. Maybe it wasn't that it was just all technical competence and they were so good at it. Maybe Romney lost because he didn't make the argument well enough, and Obama did, and Clinton lost in 2008 because she didn't make the case to the right people in 2016, and Trump did. And Trump's campaign was clearly not all that competent. It didn't know what it was doing, despite all this stuff you're now reading about its data, its big data, Cambridge Analytica, and how they're going to run everything with their psychological mass profiling. Well, they were running everything so brilliantly that they thought they'd lost the election until they were told that they had won the election. At 6 p.m. on election day, Kellyanne Conway went on television and started attacking other people in the campaign for having lost the election. So, you know, Priebus, that's right. Yeah, the wanted Reince Priebus. I guess, I don't know if they're still,
who knows. Giving her enough support in Wisconsin, which they had already lost.
That's right. So, according to her, right. So I'm just saying, like, so nobody knows. The other way of looking at the, oh, go ahead.
Well, no, it's not an important point. I was just going to say, clearly, the best advice in the 21st century now is don't go to sleep early, whether it's election night or the Super Bowl or Oscar night, because no one knows what's going on.
But I want to return to this point about Oscar night for a second, because of course it's ridiculous, and who cares whether La La Land beat Moonlight. And if Moonlight won, Moonlight didn't win because people liked it more. I'm sure so many more people saw La La Land in Hollywood than saw Moonlight that people were voting for Moonlight for obvious reasons other than its quality, is my guess, because of what it stood for, rather than whether they thought it was a better movie than La La Land. But nonetheless, so who cares? Nobody cares. The issue is that PricewaterhouseCoopers, which is a major, you know, accounting firm in the world, just humiliated itself. It's been doing this for 80-some-odd years. It does it for free, as I understand it, in order to get the publicity from the cat. It used to be Price Waterhouse, the accountants from Price Waterhouse who had the secret tally, and they're the only people who knew who won, and they have the envelopes and all of this. I mean, you know, people would like jump out windows for the shame of having done something like this in previous. It wouldn't have happened before, because the culture simply couldn't have allowed it to happen. Now, maybe what we don't know is maybe it's happened before, and the idea of exposing the error was so horrifying that no one ever exposed the error. You know, there's always been a rumor that Marissa Tomei didn't win the Oscar for My Cousin Vinny. that Jack Palance read her name off because it was the last name on the list of Best Supporting Actress nominees. And this shadow has followed her forever, and no one's ever really known the truth. And they wouldn't have corrected it because it would have called the institution of the Oscars and their probity into question. And so better to protect the institution. But no one protects any institutions anymore.
But see, I didn't know that. But you know, this also speaks to another problem with widespread incompetence, which is it produces paranoia and conspiracy theories.
Well, of course. That's the whole point. So you think there aren't going to be La La Land truthers who are going to say that it won, but that the Academy really wanted Moonlight to win because of its effort to defeat the Oscars so white. So they produced two envelopes and then they pulled some scam. I mean, there's going to be some theory about this. And look at this election. So here's something we didn't think we were going to talk about. So the Democratic National Committee election this weekend, picking Tom Perez as the chairman of the party and Keith Ellison as the vice chair. So apparently the price for entry in this race was that you basically everybody had to say that the 2016 election was falsely decided. That was Perez said it. Ellison said it. Every person on the stage said it. They want inquiries. They want inquiries into Russian meddling. They want inquiries into this, and that this was, you know, Vladimir impeachment already, but like prior fact. So what we have there, if you think about it, is the Democratic Party now so unwilling to accept the results of the election that they're willing to believe in a massive conspiracy theory suggesting the wild competence of the Russian government, which, you know, can't even feed its people and, you know, who are dying of alcoholism at astounding rates, rather than simply say, okay, we lost, let's try to figure out how to rebuild.
Well, a super cynical reading of this is that nobody on that stage believes that. They think that the Democratic base believes that, or at least they think that the Democratic base is energized enough to go out and vote and donate and do everything they need to do by the idea that Donald Trump is an illegitimate president, and thus they can energize.
Right,
their
but so we have so we now have.
But that's even more cynical.
So
than
we now have three consecutive presidents. Again, let's talk about institutional decline here. Three consecutive presidents that large numbers of people believe were elected illegitimately: George W. Bush, because the Florida recount was illegitimate, or the original election, the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County meant that people voted for Pat Buchanan who wouldn't have voted for Pat Buchanan.
Diebold.
And thus, yeah, the Diebold voting machines were fixed, and the optical and the hanging chads and all. So there were people like Paul Krugman who said, I will not call George W. Bush president because he's not my president. And then you have Obama wins this giant victory. And where is that? Suddenly it's he's not a legitimate president. He wasn't born here. Where's his birth certificate? His entire life was a Manchurian candidate conspiracy. And now you have Donald Trump who didn't win the presidency because he was elected by Vladimir Putin. So we now no longer trust that the people who are – we now – it is now an axiom of American politics that the person who is the president is illegitimate.
It is an axiom because had Hillary won, we know that Trumpians would have said it was fixed as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. 3 million – and they're saying she got right. 3 million illegal votes.
Yeah. Even the winners say it now too.
He says that her margin – and, of course – we have it's not fair that Hillary didn't win since she won the popular vote. And so the Electoral College, one of the features of our Constitution, is an illegitimate attack on our democracy. So we have a war on competence and we have a war on legitimacy, and they run hand in hand. The question is whether elite institutions – we've had all these elite institutions, not just government. I mean, the Catholic Church has gone through this crisis of legitimacy owing to the pedophilia scandal. We have, I mean, you know, mediating institutions of all kinds. The United Way, people defenestrated because of scandals. You know, the largest charity in the country, and the American Red Cross had people throw. You know, all it does is collect blood and do wonderful things, and it's bad. And you know, Greg Mortensen's school in Afghanistan is a fake, and all these things are just done for the goodness of people's heart. And so, the question you have to ask yourself is: are we heading into a time when, okay, so life has been terrible for, according to our, you know, extraordinary dominating lead article in the March commentary by Nick Eberstadt, Our Miserable 21st Century, life has gone downhill for the, you know, sort of working class, even lower middle class, you know, whites of the United States for the last 15 to 20 years. Well, if all of our elite institutions are themselves now incompetent, so PricewaterhouseCoopers is incompetent, our leading universities are now turning vastly incompetent in educating people and throwing professors out for no good reason and having fits and scenes on campuses that are preposterous. So how do we know that this contagion that Charles Murray and others have said, look, the upper order, they're going to be great. They make a lot of money and they make all the, you know, all the income inequality means that they're all profiting and their existences are fine, but that everybody else is going to suffer. Well, maybe some of this is an indication that you know, decline is totalistic, that you can't contain it to, you know, just one silent majority population, because if you can't be sure that the person who works for Pricewaterhouse doesn't hand the right envelope to Warren Beatty, you can't be sure that anything is going to work right, that your iPhone is going to work right, that your phone's going to work right, that your cable is going to work right, that your company is going to work right, nothing.
I'm sort of reminded on the subject of institutional decline and a crisis of confidence. I'm sort of reminded of the Republican primary cycle, in which a lot of us put a whole lot of empty faith in the idea that institutions like the conservative movement and the Republican Party would assert themselves and somehow thwart the idea that somebody who eventually became the president of the United States, who didn't represent any of their values initially, would overtake these institutions and these organizations. And the cavalry just never arrived. And it was as though the institutions themselves were sort of had a problem asserting their own dominance, even if that meant thwarting the will of a minority that – or even eventually a majority that they believed to not have their best interests in mind. And you've got sort of on a macro level writ large, you know, you're seeing – the idea that these institutions no longer believe in their own mission state, or certainly in their own competency. If the Academy Awards would have just stifled the idea that they made a mistake at that point, to at one point, you know, shield the institution from criticism, deserving or otherwise, and it no longer does, you know, what does that say about institutions?
Well, I think, you know, all of this makes the steady hand argument a bit of a dead letter, because if you say, look, we want someone in charge of any the country, but of anything, who can keep things on course, who's trustworthy, who we know, you know, nothing too erratic will happen. But the pushback to that is, well, but it's an illusion. You want to stay on a steady course of incompetence?
And I'm writing a piece right now for the blog that hopefully will get published. We'll see. Everybody in this room can decide. But it, you know, we had this poll over the weekend from Wall Street Journal that showed that people are very optimistic now, more optimistic than they have been in a long time. That 60% of people think the economy is going to keep growing. That's 41% say that the trajectory – or they're optimistic in the trajectory of the country. 41% of plurality think the economy is going to keep growing. And of them, 73% think Donald Trump is going to be the reason for its growth. Finally, 52% of the country, for the first time since 2002, a majority, say that no longer does the government and the economic systems that run this country has forgotten about them. They are now back a part of the system. They have faith in it. And this strikes me as really dangerous because nothing's changed. Nothing's going to change.
One thing has changed. I mean, there's been a gigantic stock market rally. So if you have a 401k, you look at your 401k numbers, they're up 22% since November.
People who are saying this, who say that the economy has forgotten about me and the political system has forgotten about me, are not looking at the Dow Jones Industrial
Average. I'm not sure that's true. 140 million people have money in the market.
What goes up must come down. Bull markets end. The business cycle will return, although it's not coming tomorrow. At some point, these people are going to look around and they will be disappointed. Mm-hmm. Well, because their expectations are such that they cannot be met.
But confidence and optimism can also be a good thing.
It is a good thing.
Yeah, right. I know. But I'm saying, so even if it's illusory, it can spur action.
I mean, I think what's striking is about that poll is that so basically, everybody who voted for Trump, right, that's 46%. First of all, it's a poll of adults, not of registered voters. So we don't know who the pool was. I didn't really get a chance to look at the demographic breakdown and whether it was friendlier to Trump than other, you know, self-selected.
It includes non-voters explicitly.
Right, right. But I'm saying, but, you know, how white was it, how this. But so we can presume that everyone who voted for Trump is not turning on Trump, and that some people who didn't vote for Trump are thinking, yeah, I mean, things are, you know, maybe he likes us, he's fighting for us, or some, just some small percentage of people who didn't vote for him or wouldn't have voted for him are thinking that. And, you know, nobody would question this if it weren't that it was he. In other words, it's been a month and, you know, we're not at war and he's made a lot of mistakes, but they are not following it granularly with the way we are, and they don't know what the hell is going on. And for all they, for what a lot of them think is, he's like doing something about terrorism with the executive order, and he's doing something about immigration, which a lot of them don't like, and the media doesn't like him, and they don't care about that. So so one could read too much into this. He's not had a honeymoon because, like, his numbers are in the 60s, and his approval rating in this poll is at 44. I mean, it's not at 54; it's at 44.
That's why the focus on his particular base of voters is so bizarre. And it's not dissimilar from what we experienced in 2009, when the hope and change sentiment was its own sort of unique species that needed forensic analysis and vivisection. And we're going through that same thing right now. But it doesn't take long for that sentiment to wear off. And, you look back on the profiles of the hope and change voter are not happy. They're all very dispiriting. And how many times can you be dispirited? How many times can you have hope and faith and have it dashed before you either tune out entirely or look to other options?
Okay, so let's break this down between the radical differences between Obama and what hope and change would mean for an Obama-friendly person and hope and change would mean for a Trump-friendly person. So for an Obama-friendly person, hope and change would mean racial conciliation. We elected the first black president. I feel really good about that because it means the society is changing and he's going to do all these good things. And Bush was such a screw up and they're really going to do something to stimulate the economy and rebuild things and make things better. And maybe they'll do something about health care and all of that. And the Trump-friendly voter is finally someone's come in to give those guys hell. And they all stink, and they're terrible. And he's coming to give them hell. And he wants to help people like me. And you know, somebody finally cares about somebody like me, because for all I ever hear about is minorities and gay people and this and that. No one ever talks about people like me. And so finally, he's talking about people like me. These are two very different populations, as far as I can tell, and they are equally susceptible, I think you're right, to extreme disappointment when whatever care he might want to show to people like him isn't going to necessarily translate unless there is an economic boom.
But it's a Venn diagram. These aren't two completely isolated populations.
No, but
there's overlap.
There's substantial overlap. I don't think there's substantial overlap. There's some overlap. There is not that much overlap. It's just simply – but in other words, you know, Trump offers hope to the populist, and Obama offered hope to the collectivist, or to the, you know, to the person who believed, you know, that America's best day, you know, America's promise is a multicultural future of, you know, of great racial comedy, and that is not Trump is. You know, finally someone is going to stick it to those guys in Washington and, you know, and give me some stuff that I didn't get before.
But also, Noah, why do you say that the hope and changers are so distraught? I mean, now they're distraught about Trump, but at the end of Obama's second term. I mean, there are some that from whom you hear he should have gone right. I was hoping for more. He should have gone farther than he did.
Yeah.
But I think mostly they actually consider it to have lived through, like, you know, this wonderful, noble president.
There's anecdotes on both sides. You can, and when you're focusing on the anecdotal evidence, this person is disappointed. This person is not. This person remains super happy with Obama and his era. I mean, you're you're going to get a distorted picture. If you look at the fact that minority turnout was down in 2016 substantially, that Hillary Clinton failed to draw African-American voters to the polls by the tune of 10 points, you had African-American voters in states like Michigan that declined to turn out and told New York Times they were super happy with that. And also Barack Obama was replaced by his polar opposite who promised to do everything he didn't want, everything to undo everything the Obama presidency. Those are the effects of Obama's legacy, and by that you can judge him to have been a disappointment to his voters.
Well, except that he left office with a 56% approval rating. So a lot of this is not – you know, a lot of this we have to look, we're looking, you know, too close at the microscope, and we're going to need to pull back and look at this in a grander way over time when we really get a sense of how the American people are going to view their conditions in a macro sense. Since, of course, Trump is still, we always have to point out, to be fair, Trump got 46% of the vote. Obama got 51% and 53.5%. On, you know, the two previous elections, he got 46, Hillary got 48, he got 63 million votes, Hillary got 66 million votes. I mean, that's just the fact of the matter. He's still a minority president, and the main thing for him is that unlike other minority presidents, let's say, he is not reaching out. That is not his style. He is polarizing, not reaching out. And so the proof of the pudding for him will be entirely in terms of performance. The economy grows substantially in a way that spreads its benefits down the socio, you know, I can't spread down, but I mean that they actually affect people down the socioeconomic ladder, then he will benefit. And if they don't, he will be in disastrous condition.
And this is the point of my post, and it also dovetails with what Eberstadt said. I mean, we're looking at, we don't have any recessionary trends on the indicator. And we have manufacturing is up. Consumer goods are up. Consumer confidence is up. Food is up. Our unemployment rate officially is under 5%. The stock market is rallying. GDP growth is anemic, but it's growing. In those terms of those indices, things are good. And then you have Eberstadt who writes, well, the indexes are wrong. They're measuring the wrong things. What we have is an economy that is marked by a labor participation rate that is something in the 70s. People are out of work and they're not looking for work. They're drugging themselves. Income is poorly distributed, et cetera, so forth. So you've got what looks to be less of an economic crisis and more of a moral crisis. And how on earth can Donald Trump address that?
He can't. That's right.
Precisely. But, so right. If they lean into this idea are the ones we have been waiting for, a la Obama, he's right. Setting himself up for failure.
Well, that's right, except for the fact that in general terms, he will either perform well or he won't perform well. I mean, the thing about Obama was it all depends on how you want to look at it. Obama had an incredibly productive first 16 months. He passed four gigantic, you know, world historical pieces of legislation that ended up getting him, you know, get Democrats thrown out of the House and ended up getting Democrats, I think, 3 years, really, in fact, thrown out of the Senate 4 years later, but did not get him kicked out of office because enough people thought that he had done a good enough job and that Romney wasn't somebody that they wanted to be president, that he stuck with them. And yet he was the least productive president. He was the most productive president that we've ever seen since Roosevelt in the first 16 months. And the least productive president in the last 7 years of his presidency. I mean, somebody who literally got nothing done at all, whatsoever, except things that did not have to pass congressional muster, like the Iran deal. He got nothing done. Trump does not have the luxury of getting nothing done. If he gets nothing done, particularly with a House and a Senate that are Republican, and he doesn't get enough done, what's he going to say? He's going to say, who stopped him? How did it not? He will be to blame for everything. He's got no cover. The only enemy that he has is the media. Only enemy that he's set up is the media.
Not necessarily. Then we go back to the very beginning topic of our study here, which is elite crisis of confidence, the collapse of institutions, a crisis of competence among our officials and members of elite society, and all of that can and will, frankly, in my opinion, be used by Donald Trump to shift blame from his own failures in the event that they occur. And it will be done so pretty convincingly because these elite institutions won't fight back.
But, you know, it also depends, as it did in the case of Obama, on the strength and endurance of the cult of personality. I mean, there are once you are invested in an individual, you will not express buyer's remorse no matter what. You can always find someone else to blame it on, someone who tried to get in his way, someone who didn't let him do the great things that he was capable of doing otherwise.
Right, but the other problem Trump faces is that he sold himself as the guy who could fix it. Obama sold himself as the person who would end things that Bush had started and would bring a new spirit to the country, a better spirit, a more optimistic spirit. Trump's the guy who said, I alone can solve. And he's the guy who went on campaign trails and said, I will make all your dreams come true. On the one hand, he will be able to say the media stopped me or the swamp stopped me or something like that. The other thing, by the way, is that we have various things going on this week, right? He's going to announce some new health, the Obamacare replacement plan tomorrow night in his speech before Congress. Apparently doing so because the Capitol Hill, Republicans on Capitol Hill are now suddenly in their own crisis of confidence about what on earth they can suggest that isn't going to get them in trouble with voters. The theory of the repeal and replacement of Obamacare is popular, but now they're terrified of dropping any provision, any feel-good provision from Obamacare. So Trump is going to have to do it. And you know what happens when presidents propose giant plans to fix things? They generally die. They drop dead. Sometimes a tax plan can come out of the White House, but very rarely. In fact, the most important tax plan of modern times, which was the Reagan tax cuts, that was the Kemp-Roth tax cut plan that he adopted from Congress. What plans have we seen come out of the White House in our career? Clinton care proposal that died the death of it. And he had a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate, and they didn't like it. And they didn't let him have it. Now, that was because it was overly bureaucratic and too left wing for, you know, conservative Democrats. But nonetheless, I it's not good that proposals float down from the White House. They should be emerging organically from Congress, and then Trump can sign them with great fanfare. As Noah says, it is, of course, a nightmare that they're doing it this way. It's crazy. There's no consensus on the right about what to do. And what they ought to be doing first is tax reform, because there isn't full consensus on tax reform. Paul Ryan has this controversial provision that people in the Senate don't like and that Obama either likes or doesn't like, depending on who you listen to. Trump doesn't like or listen to. But nonetheless, there is a general sense that, you know, we need to reform the corporate income tax. We need to delay. We need to provide some tax cutting to people to help the economy get going. And instead, they're going to take up the hardest thing instead of the easiest. And they're going to end up, you know, a wash and a mire rather than getting themselves a quick and easy victory, which is, I think, not a very good sign about the competence and expertise of the House and the Senate. You know, I mean, Paul Ryan is Speaker of the House. He's an incredibly impressive man intellectually and procedurally. But, you know, he basically became a committee chairman in a time when you couldn't get any legislation through. And now he's the Speaker of the House and they're having trouble crafting bills that the House can agree on and that the Senate will agree to. And it's not clear that there's a huge amount of competence there, and there's clearly very little competence in the White House or in much of the administration, whether you like them or not. I don't know how you can look at this and say that it's going well. You're only saying it's going well because you like him and you don't want to say it's going badly.
There's also a very ideological Congress, more so than – you know, probably most Congresses in the past. And even though we're in the midst of this sort of anti-ideological period when it comes – if you look at the White House, you know, the Congress is really a very conservative Congress and young Congress, which probably makes them more ideological. So that's one of the reasons, I guess, why we're having such problems coming to terms with some sort of a pragmatic solution to fixing or quote-unquote repealing and replacing Obamacare, is that everybody has their ideological priors. And that's why we can't do tax code reform, by the way, because if they didn't, all the ideologues in the grassroots would have a very big problem with that.
Right. Well, so Trump is giving the speech Tuesday and is supposed to drop his new draft of the executive order on refugees from and visas from seven majority Muslim countries, as we say. Will this be another tempest, or will a sensible redrafting cause a Democratic explosion, Democratic and liberal explosion, that will actually redound to Trump's benefit if the order solves some of the problems that the previous order did not? Abe, what do you think?
Well, you know, in keeping with our theme about competency, the administration has said that they're crossing all their T's and dotting all their I's in this one because they want it to be absolutely perfect. You know, they sense the doubt that was engendered by their last round. I think a successful executive order on immigration will drive the Democrats much crazier than an unsuccessful one did, by all means, because they don't have the ability to yell about how it's illegal and sloppy and unconstitutional and if it's in fact not those things, if it's just bad.
Well, they got preemptively sort of undermined by the Department of Homeland Security, where somehow a report that was not made for public consumption was leaked out, an analysis of the conditions that Donald Trump has – Trump's administration says is the justification for this ban, indicating that only two of the seven countries that have been targeted are really good reliable indicators of possible terrorism. For example, one of the countries on that list, Iran, is one of the places where we have introduced most of our visas to North America – I'm sorry, North Africa and the Middle East. And we've been assimilating and introducing people from Iran into this country for a very long time. Go to Los Angeles. You'll meet a couple. Whereas the other indicators of states that also are indicators of terrorist exportation, like Uzbekistan and Cuba and places that we otherwise don't think of as terrorist exporters, they didn't make it on the list. So this thing sort of undermined the White House before it could get underway. And by the way, it prompted communications people over at DHS to attack their own analysts and intelligence report preparers as insufficiently studious, or taking account of all the information to which they could be privy, but they wanted to produce a partisan product.
I mean, in the end, what's key here is that the technical attack on the you know, so-called Muslim ban, it was, of course, just a matter of procedure. The problem with it in the eyes of the people who really hate it is the policy, not its, you know, not difficulties in its framing and constitutionality about what happens with people with green cards and what happens with people who are already in transit and all of that. That was a... it's not that that's a bluff. That's a secondary issue. They don't like the policy to begin with. And then we had an interesting voice this morning basically going after the policy, and that was the voice out of nowhere of George W. Bush saying that the country needs to be welcoming to immigrants and you know, big-hearted when it comes to these things. And it's just interesting to see Bush, you know, remain quiet through most of the Obama years and decide, you know, maybe after being so viciously attacked by Trump during the course of the campaign, that he was not necessarily going to feel himself obliged to remain silent. I don't know what help he's going to give. It'll be sort of interesting to see whether the people who reviled him so much are now suddenly going to find in him someone that they want to cite and admire.
As we are recording this, and I can't independently verify, but I am getting a dispatch that says Rush Limbaugh is being very critical of George W. Bush, who is quote-unquote establishment and is trying to undermine the president for his own personal politics and legacy.
Yeah, well, there you go. So, you know, the man who makes $30 million a year speaking on the radio is accusing other people of being establishment. That's always funny to me. Anyway, the life that we live is a life in which if you say anything that does not comport with the interests of the people who like Trump, the first thing they do is they call you an elitist and someone in the establishment, and I will cop to being kind of an elitist as the editor of Commentary Magazine, a magazine that has spent 72 years attempting to provide the best of intellectual analysis and probity in its cultural analysis. I invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com for a few free reads, and then we ask you to pay $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox. And so the week will go on, and we will remain elitist and out of touch and snobbish and terrible, and La La Land should have won. And I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, with Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald. Keep the candle burning.